voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: 10 Palestinians are killed and dozens wounded in the latest Israeli incursion into the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Officials of the International Atomic Energy Agency are in Tehran to remove ambiguities recently raised by agency inspectors regarding Iran's uranium enrichment level. And Russia's President Putin tells visiting Chinese top diplomat the cooperation between Beijing and Moscow is important to, quote, stabilize the international situation. This has been news. Thanks for joining us. The death toll from a fresh Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus has risen to 10. Fatalities include a 14-year-old boy. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad says two of its commanders are among those killed. Some 100 people have also been injured, some of them critically. The Israeli regime has intensified its crackdown on Nablus and the nearby city of Jenin ever since the formation of a far-right cabinet led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. 60 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank alone since the turn of the year. Ashraf Shannon is our correspondent joining us from Gaza City to tell us more about this. Ashraf, at this point, tell us or give us a roundup of how many people have been injured and how many have been killed. And in particular, with the injured, the reports indicate that many of them were injured with multiple gunshot wounds. Is that accurate?
Yes, Kaveh. What really happened today is nothing short of a massacre. Another massacre added to the a list of Israeli massacres throughout the last at least 7 decades as Israeli special forces raided the occupied West Bank town of Nablus, basically executing people in that area. At least 10 people have died so far, or at least 10 have been confirmed, with around 7 or 8 others in critical condition. All the injuries were with live ammunition, so it just shows that the intention of the Israeli special forces was to come in and kill people in cold blood. Some witnesses have said that some of the Israeli special forces were dressed in Islamic clothing and they were inside one of the mosques in the area and they wrapped their guns in a prayer rug. And all of a sudden, they unrolled the rug and took out the machine gun and start shooting at those allegedly wanted by the Israeli regime. This while the Palestinian leadership in the occupied West Bank town of Ramallah has condemned the recent Israeli bloodshed in Nablus, while Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned in the strongest terms this latest Israeli massacre in the occupied West Bank. Meanwhile, Hamas's the spokesman of Hamas's military wing, the Zir Qassam Brigades, Abu Ubaidah, said that the Israeli regime is testing the patience of the Palestinian resistance. And many people here in Gaza are bracing themselves for what may happen tonight, as a lot of people you talk to in Gaza, analysts and experts, say that it's very likely that Palestinian resistance groups will fire rockets towards the occupied territories targeting Israeli, maybe Israeli army bases or something similar. And definitely the Israeli regime will fire back. We have to understand that if the Palestinian resistance groups fire rockets at the Israeli regime or Israeli army bases, they are retaliating to the crimes in the occupied West Bank. For Palestinians, any Palestinian anywhere, the blood of the Palestinians will not go in vain. And we've seen that back in 2021 during the Sword of Al-Quds battle when Hamas's military wing, the Zedin Qassam Brigades, fired rockets towards Al-Quds, and that war lasted for 11 days. Now, for tomorrow, the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank are planning to hold a day of mourning. No shops will be opened. Also, all schools and universities will be shuttered tomorrow, whether in the occupied West Bank or the Gaza Strip. While tonight already some protests were taking place in Gaza to condemn this Israeli bloodshed in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus.
Thank you so much for that. Ashraf Shannon there from Gaza City. Meanwhile, Palestinian officials and resistance factions have strongly condemned the fatal raid on the West Bank city of Nablus. The Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh says the raid is part of systematic terrorism. He urged the UN to stop adopting double standards that encourages Israel to go on with its crimes against Palestinians. Shtayyeh stressed the Israeli practices won't undermine the Palestinians' legitimate struggle aimed at ending the occupation. The top Hamas figure has also denounced the, quote, brutal extrajudicial execution of Palestinians in Nablus. Hisham Qassam said the right response to the massacres is the activation of resistance in all occupied Palestinian territories and retaliatory attacks against Israeli forces and settlers. Meanwhile, a spokesman for the military wing of Hamas, the Izzedin Al-Qassam Brigades, has also warned that the resistance front is running out of patience. Officials of the International Atomic Energy Agency are in Tehran to remove ambiguities recently raised by agency's inspectors regarding Iran's uranium enrichment level. That's according to the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran.
We maintain our relationship with the IAEA within the bounds of the safeguards. Regarding the matters that the agency inspector had mentioned, IAEA officials have been in Tehran since yesterday. They are negotiating, visiting, and inspecting, and the ambiguities caused by an incorrect takeaway by one inspector have been resolved or are being resolved.
Mohammed Islami was referring to a report by Bloomberg claiming inspectors of the IAEA have found enriched uranium beyond permitted levels. He also talked about the negotiations to revive the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Islami said the Western parties to the pact have not fulfilled their commitments. On the same note, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has said that Tehran will switch to his plan B if Washington obstructs the talks. Amir Abdollahian stressed that Tehran is ready to take steps to conclude the discussions provided Iran's red lines are respected. He said that Iran has been receiving mixed messages from the U.S. regarding the revival of the deal. Iran's foreign minister is in Iraq for an official visit aimed at building up bilateral ties and developing regional cooperation. In a meeting with his Iraqi counterpart in Baghdad, Hossein Amir Abdollahian described as unacceptable the presence of some terrorists and separatist groups in Iraq. The top Iranian diplomat warned that Iraq must not turn into a stage for terrorist attacks against Iran. Amir Abdollahian said the Islamic Republic supports an independent Iraq, expressing hope that Iraqi parliament's resolution on expelling foreign troops would be fully implemented. Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein, for his part, said the Iraqi constitution does not allow the country to be used as a base to launch threats against its neighbors, including Iran. Fuad Hussein also said Baghdad is determined to put on trial those behind the 2020 assassination of Iran's top commander, General Qasem Soleimani, and his Iraqi companion, Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas. British lawmakers have revoked the parliamentary pass of former British Labour MP Chris Williamson for hosting a show on Press TV. The House of Commons committee made the decision as it reviewed Williamson's security pass over alleged concerns. Williamson has attributed the move to his position as a presenter of a weekly program on Press TV about Palestine and to his criticism of the UK government's support for, quote, the NATO's proxy war in Ukraine. The 66-year-old has been hosting a Press TV Palestine Declassified alongside SAC Bristol University professor David Miller since early last year. The European Union and the U.S. have targeted Press TV with sanctions since foreign-backed riots erupted in Iran last September. Well, let's bring in Chris Williamson, former British MP and Press TV host, to find out from him directly what is going on. Welcome to the program, first of all. You have your pass revoked at this point, and it's for two really issues from what you even tweeted, and one is for obviously the show and its view on Israel and Palestine, the other for the Ukraine conflict. But what do you think would be the real reason for this, or the reason for this revocation?
Well, I think I've set it out really there. I mean, what they say in the letter that I received from the chair of the committee is that the fact that I host a program on Press TV, which he claims has been banned in the UK, it has the potential to bring Parliament into disrepute. I mean, it's an absurdity, and I've written back to the chair of the committee, Sir Charles Walker, to ask them to revise it, to actually change it, because it has no basis, really, and it's a very dangerous, slippery slope that Parliament is going down here in terms of free speech. I mean, the Parliament claims to be the home of democracy, the mother of parliaments, and yet here we are, parliamentarians clamping down on free speech. I mean, what have they got to be frightened about? I mean, I host a programme about the struggle, Palestine struggle for freedom. It'd be interesting to find how many of the people who made the decision are members of the various Friends of Israel groups, which are quite prevalent across Parliament. A vast majority, indeed, of members of Parliament are members of organisations known as either Conservative Friends of Israel or Labour Friends of Israel. So it'd be interesting also to I've not actually been able to find that out yet as to who it was that finally voted and made the decision, but I'll be asking those questions of the chair of the committee, say, and to give me an opportunity to actually put my, this is kind of principles of natural, didn't even find out formally about the decision from Sir Charles Walker from the parliamentary committee. I heard about it, first of all, from the media. So it seems they told them. So this whole thing stinks, it seems to me, and I hope that they will reflect on the decision and change their minds and reinstate the pass. I think clearly the Zionist lobby is very exercised about the fact that the Palestine Declassified show is gaining traction now. I mean, they're doing their very best to suppress the reach of the show, but it is increasing the reach every week. So they have determined to suppress, to actually cancel out any alternative narrative to the one that they want to give to the public, that Israel is the bastion of democracy, and that the Palestinians are essentially terrorists supporting the population. And I mean, obviously, as we know, the real terrorists here are the Israeli entity, the Zionist regime. They're the real perpetrators of terrorism, as you've just pointed out there. I mean, these massacres, the treatment of the Palestinian people is absolutely despicable. And of course, we highlight that on Palestine Declassified, and we also highlight the efforts that they go to as it were, suppress that information and to influence key players in society, in Parliament, in the media, in the entertainment field. And that is something, obviously, that is unconscionable to them, and they're doing everything they can to try and stop that. And clearly, this is one of the steps that they're taking in a vindictive way to remove my pass. Actually, it would make no real difference to me, because I've not actually set foot back in Parliament since I left Parliament in 2019. So I've not actually used the pass. But there is an important principle at stake here, and I think I will be pushing the committee to, as I say, revise its decision and to reinstate the pass. Because, I mean, look, I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, it's pretty clear that, they've targeted me because, we're embarrassing the, the Zionist lobby. We're exposing what Israel is all about. It's not really any concern, it seems to me, about Iran, because, I mean, there are other parliamentarians who quite properly are involved in, for example, the British Iranian Chamber of Commerce, which promotes business links and promotes trade between Iran and the UK. I mean, last year there was a huge increase actually in trading. It worked at something in the order of £670 million. People like Norman Lamont, former Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jack Straw, former Home Secretary, they are the President and Chair of the British Iranian Chamber of Commerce, respectively. So, you know, they can come and go as they please. I mean, and you know, they're promoting quite rightly those trade links. So it seems to me this is very clearly because of the fact that we are exposing the Israeli regime for what it really is.
Very well, thank you very much. We appreciate that, Chris Williamson, former British MP and Press TV host. The Russian lower house of parliament, or State Duma, has voted to suspend Moscow's participation in the new START nuclear arms treaty with Washington. The swift action came after the chairman of Duma accused the U.S. of creating global chaos by not honoring commitments on security issues. The new START was the last major pact between the two countries which limited their deployed strategic nuclear arsenals. Russia and the U.S. possess nearly 90% of the world's nuclear warheads. Putin proposed the suspension of the treaty during his Tuesday annual State of the Nation address, stressing that Moscow has been forced to take such a step. That's because he said the West plans to inflict a strategic defeat on Russia and to claim its nuclear facilities. The Russian president has hailed cooperation between his country and China, describing it as an important step in stabilizing the international situation.
The cooperation in the international arena between the People's Republic of China and the Russian Federation, as we have repeatedly underlined, plays an important role in stabilizing the international situation.
Vladimir Putin made the remarks during a meeting with the visiting Chinese top foreign policy advisor Wang Yi in Moscow. He added that two countries are reaching new milestones in cooperation and development. China's top diplomat, for his part, expressed Beijing's readiness to strengthen strategic partnership and to cooperate with Moscow. He stressed that such a partnership is not directed against any third party. Wang also met with the Russian foreign minister earlier on Wednesday. In that meeting, Sergei Lavrov highlighted the two countries' solidarity, despite what he called the high turbulence of the world stage. He also stressed both sides' readiness to defend each other's interests based on international law. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yani.
Bazaar.
Whether man-made or not, food can have fascinating backstories. Products usually take a long journey before they end up on the dining table. Nevertheless, the food industry follows several golden rules that have helped it steadily grow over time. The most important of these is continuous product innovation and improved production processes to reduce costs and wastage. Others involve packaging and product accessibility, but probably the king of all rules is the taste that drives the food industry.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the weekly programme that analyses markets, profits, industries and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This week we will be exploring the food industry and its related agricultural markets. We wanted to see how the food sector has expanded over the years and what companies are doing to increase their profits. So, let's check out the Tasty Grub.
To become more familiar with how much work goes into food production, we visited Golha Food Industries. It was established nearly a century ago, and its products are now a household name. It produces hundreds of items in seven categories, such as dried legumes and fruit, spices and canned products. It also takes great pride in its healthy product line, including gluten-free flour products. This producer has devoted a lot of attention to the packaging of its products. Due to its diverse product list, it purchases such materials as cans, plastic, and cardboard to design the appropriate type of storage systems for distribution. The company has a massive daily output due to its expansive production facilities. Most of the work is done by automated machines, but the fine details are handled by experienced staff. All production processes start when raw material enters the company. These materials are first tested for quality before hitting the production floors, most of which are domestically supplied. After being tested, the material is sent to various closed circuit machines for processing. Then it is time for sorting and more quality control tests before packaging. Food production is a very sensitive process requiring many checks and controls that guarantee the final product is safe for consumption. And production machines play an essential role as they reduce errors and maintain constant output results. Plus, many of these machines have been domestically engineered, whereas they were previously imported at high prices. This company has a highly equipped quality control and research and development lab. It's where many new products are created and food safety standards are controlled. Moreover, the staff in this department implement food sciences to make innovative products. It might be interesting to know that this department also has some of the best food tasters. This producer has been awarded Best Research and Development Department in Food Production for many consecutive years. Among its many achievements, it has also been awarded the certificate of favored brand by customers. This wouldn't be possible without adhering to strict national and international food safety and production management standards. Following such standards has helped it maintain its export share in the global food market. With years of experience, this company has grown such that it provides thousands of employment opportunities, both directly and indirectly. It also has thousands of agencies and stores all over the country. Plus, its products can also be purchased online. As part of its future vision, this company is looking to increase its market share both domestically and abroad. It also has long-term plans to increase production and improve the production process for efficiency. The Iranian food industry has taken giant strides away from its traditional production methods. Industry participants say using food sciences and new technologies has helped the food industry grow faster than before. Never more than now has food been more accessible. In fact, it only requires a touch of a few buttons to receive it at home. Therefore, food packaging is a critical part of the production. Over the last decade, there has been a great emphasis on developing packaging for the food industry. This is because Iran indigenized many machines needed to process and produce food items, such as deli meats, beverages, pickles, and so much more. Proper packaging also increases shelf life, which is important for consumers. Previously, food items such as spices and dairy products were purchased bulk from customers abroad due to a lack of packaging. While exporting items in bulk has benefits, it's not as profitable as selling prepackaged foodstuff. So, in addition to adding value to raw products such as meat, companies have also designed attractive packaging to contain food in more manageable portions.
Such a strategy increases not only product quality, but also food safety, which helps producers meet international export standards. This trend also helps companies with branding and has created job opportunities for designers.
As you probably already know, the food industry is heavily dependent on production in the agriculture sector. So it's no surprise that the agriculture sector holds the pulse of national food security and food exports. Plus, it is one of the only sectors that has been barely impacted by the US-imposed sanctions and the global coronavirus outbreak. That was horrible.
We looked at some figures from the Ministry of Agriculture to see how this sector is doing. Last year, around 6 million tons of agricultural and foodstuff products were exported. Trade of these products raked in roughly $4 billion. Pistachio, saffron, and confectionery products topped the export charts in value during that period. Other agriculture sectors, such as livestock, poultry, and aquaculture, have also generated millions of dollars in exports. Last year, nearly 450,000 tons of these items were sent to markets in neighboring regions, worth $500 million. Agriculture accounts for 8% of the country's gross domestic product. It might be interesting to know that around half of Iran's total non-oil trade comes from this sector. That's all based on data from Iran's Ministry of Agriculture. According to Iran's Customs Administration, the total non-oil trade value rose nearly 40% last year. Over 120 million tons of non-oil products worth $72 billion were traded with other countries in that period. Meanwhile, the government has implemented measures to encourage the development of agriculture. One trend this sector is witnessing is the application of smart technologies for the cultivation and harvest of various products. There has also been a boom in developing greenhouses and green practices to preserve natural resources. The word plastic was initially used to describe pliable and easily shaped objects. However, it only recently became a name for a category of materials called polymers. Such materials are abundant in nature. Take cellulose, for example. It's the material that makes up the cell walls of plants. However, synthetic polymers are a more recent invention of the last 150 years. These come from the plentiful carbon atoms found in fossil fuels. Since then, they have become an integral part of the industry, technology, and even various sciences.
We will explore Iran's plastic and polymer productions. We will also check out some of its downstream markets and their contributions to the national economy. These days, we use more plastic than ever before. It's terrible. So where does this material come from? And what goes into making this stuff? Let's find out.
Our quest for answers led us to a company specializing in making various polymer products. Parsa Polymer Sharif was established some 20 years ago and is a knowledge-based company that was born in the research department of the University of Sharif. As a leading advanced polymer compound manufacturer, it makes various products essential to everyday living. It produces compounds based on commodity thermoplastic resins like PP, PE, and the famous PET, or PET. It also engineers resins like PVC and so much more. This knowledge-based company is a major supplier of raw materials to many industries. Some include original equipment manufacturers in the automotive market and PVC pipe producers in the construction industry. Over the years, this company has helped Iran save millions on products that would otherwise be imported. This firm has three main functions: research and development, innovation center, and production. It also has a brand new line for researching and producing biodegradable polymers for the packaging industry. Most of the raw materials needed for production are domestically purchased. When this stuff enters the company, it is first tested and graded based on its quality. Then, according to its intended use, the raw material is formulated and sent to machines for production.
Machines used in the polymer industry utilizes some of the most advanced machinery for production. The extruder is one of the most commonly used machines. They play a central role in plastic production. Extruder lines are the largest converters of plastics worldwide. Some of these machines can be domestically manufactured while others are still imported.
Its products are all tested in its well-equipped research and development lab. The various granules and resin compounds undergo over a dozen tests while being analyzed for quality here. Also, new product formulas are created in this highly technical research and development department. Through these facilities, the company is expanding its product portfolio. Products made here are produced along the lines of exports. So, national and international quality standards are implemented during the production processes. This means the quality of products found here doesn't just match international standards, they go beyond the quality of competing foreign brands in the international arena. The headquarters of this company is located in Sharif University Advanced Technologies Incubator. Owing to this, it has strong relations and collaborations with the scientific community. It has also been awarded for its contributions to the scientific and industrial sectors over the past years. This knowledge-based company also exports its products. The company has a unique future vision strongly intertwined with sustainable business development. This is partly due to its forward-thinking and social and environmental responsibility outlook.
Now, polymers are the primary materials that build many other products. Plastic items have different polymer formulations depending on their application. The majority of polymers made in Iran are domestically consumed. Some of its biggest customers are in the construction sector. Also, plastic is extensively used in the medical industry and transportation.
Almost everything around us is either made of plastic or has some plastic component. Moreover, plastic has played a central role in the development of the medical industry over the past 60 years. These materials are used to create hemodialysis machines, disposable needles, IV drips, and testing equipment vital to modern medicine. Plastics have also had a considerable impact on developing high-quality prosthetics. The National Medical Device Directorate estimates that Iran's share in the global medical device market will reach well over $7 billion in the next 3 years. PVC materials are also largely used in Iran's construction industry. For example, Iran's Doors and Windows Manufacturers Association estimates the domestic demand for PVC doors and windows is around 35,000 tons annually. This is partly due to the current residential construction boom in the country. The home appliance industry is also another mammoth customer of the polymer industry. Based on figures from the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade, Iran has doubled its production in this sector over the last 3 years. In 2021, around 15 million home appliance units were produced, with exports soaring to roughly $140 million. So, polymer production is key in expanding many manufacturing industries, which have raked in large amounts of foreign revenue for the country.
Well, I believe it is that time of the show where I should take a little break and pass the action over to my good friend and colleague out there on the field. Take it away.
Despite all the advancements in technology and the problems it has solved, food security is one it hasn't. In fact, it is becoming more and more of an issue beyond the countries that have always been grappling with it. One solution is to, well, end inflation and the global economic crisis, but that's hardly a solution. There's no end in sight with that. But another way is to use technology to make things more efficient. We wouldn't be needing more land because we're not getting it thanks to desertification of more and more land. We also wouldn't be needing more water because we're also not getting it, also thanks to desertification. We would actually need less of both, if only we could manage our resources better.
Iran has some potential for farming and agriculture, and that's a massive understatement if you've ever heard one. But we could definitely do with some improvements, some innovations in the field, especially with irrigation, because, well, we've been experiencing some drought and some water shortages a little bit more than what climate change would warrant. And that's why we're here to check out a smart greenhouse that believes has the answer, that the shakeup that the industry needs to be a lot more efficient, especially with water, plus some extra goodies. So stay tuned to this episode of The Bazaar to check out what they've been able to come up with.
About that efficiency, greenhouses can help provide that by creating a controlled environment that, while it could be much smaller than a field, it can yield higher quality produce and more produce per acre. Greenhouses can protect the crops and vegetables from extreme weather conditions, pests, or really any other external threat. The parameters that are controlled in a greenhouse are light, ventilation, humidity, and temperature. This would allow the farmers to create the kind of optimal micro-ecosystem that would eventually lead to them growing healthier, tastier, more nutritious, and, you know, better-looking produce.
What you will find in this smart greenhouse are tomatoes, cherry tomatoes, bell pepper, and cucumbers. There are certain types of fruits and vegetables that are preferred to be used in greenhouses, for example, the ones that I just mentioned. And there are certain types of crops that are not optimal for greenhouse use, for example, wheat and rice. I mean, look at all this vertical space that will be wasted if you were to plant wheat in here. So, but that's just some information about greenhouses in general. What makes this particular greenhouse unique and smart is that all of the parameters that need to be kept in check in a greenhouse are all monitored and manipulated remotely through the cloud and Internet of Things, instead of some worker or some farmers coming in and out of the greenhouse to manipulate things manually. That's the smart aspect of it in a nutshell. But to find out more information about the smartness of this greenhouse, let's hear from some of the experts here.
In this greenhouse, we measure all essential parameters for the plants, like temperature, moisture, CO2, ambient light, the water parameters, and the moisture of the roots, using the available sensors and control them with the actuators and the smart control unit. And also remotely control it via Internet of Things. With properly controlling the climate and the irrigation system, we increase the productivity up to 30% and decrease the water consumption by up to 40% comparing other hydroponic greenhouses in our country. And in the next step, we are trying to recycle the drained water of the irrigation system and pass it through some filters and put it back again into the irrigation system in order to further decrease the water consumption. And also, we are developing a robotic harvester, including a mobile-based manipulator, soft gripper, and vision system equipped with artificial intelligent algorithm in order to detect the ripe crops and pick them in the proper time.
1% of the world's water resources are fresh water, and most of it, in fact, 70% of it, is used in agriculture. What we choose to do with that tiny, finite reserve is a responsibility that we need to bear. Greenhouses can control the irrigation of plants. You may have sophisticated plumbing systems in the ground or in the cocopeats, as you will see, to prevent overwatering, which can promote rots and fungal diseases, and reduce evaporation, saving huge amounts of water in the process. There is even the option to recycle the runoff water and put it back into the system to further save up on water. The great thing about this particular smart greenhouse is that you don't need to be born into a farmer family that has thousands of acres of land to make this a viable option to you. You can own land as small as 100 square meters and it would still be a financially viable option for you, especially since after the initial installation phase and the setup process, you won't be needing much manpower to control the environment.
Interest has been shown in this smart greenhouse by certain countries, especially in Africa, such as Kenya, Niger, and Ethiopia. The idea, and of course the working proof of the idea, really has the potential to shake up the industry. And if it catches on, it can only mean good things for the farmers and the food sector in general. Thank you for staying tuned to another episode of Bazaar.
Many thanks for that wonderful report. Now for our final portion of the program, let's check out some news and trends in the food and agriculture industries and some of its related trades. Each year, millions of tons of food go to waste. That's awful. Now a United Nations report shows that Iranians have the lowest food waste per capita in the West Asian region.
The report was put together by the Food Waste Index from the UN's Environment Programme. It shows that regardless of income, every Iranian throws away an average of 70 kilograms of food per year. This is below the global average set at nearly 80 kilograms. Food is mainly wasted in three areas: homes, food services, and retail. Household food waste accounted for the highest at 60% of this total.
The agriculture sector is shifting towards technology to realize a new generation of agriculture in the country. Iranian knowledge-based companies have developed dozens of technological products in this field.
The Vice Presidential Office for Science and Technology says some 120 technologies have already been produced by 30 knowledge-based companies. These items are now being integrated into the industry. The products cover everything from cultivation to harvest and sales of crops and play an essential role in the productivity and sustainability of crops.
Agriculture is one of the fields in which nanotechnology has been able to develop. Over 50 widely used nano products have been launched in this sector this year alone.
The potential of nanotechnology in agriculture is high. Over 7,000 knowledge-based companies in the country are actively manufacturing a wide range of domestically needed products. Roughly 260 companies of this total are active in agriculture, biotechnology, and the food industry.
Well, that brings us to the end of our show today. I've been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next Bazaar.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we will be with you with the explanation of Dua ul-Kumail, the commentary of different parts of this Kumail supplication by the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam. We'll be back after you listen to the parts we're going to discuss.
Ya Rabbi, Ya Rabbi, Ya Rab, Qawwi ala khidmatika jawarihi, Washdud ala al-azimati jawanihi. خشيتك والدوام في الاتصال بخدمتك حتى أسرح إليك في ميادين السابقين.
Brothers and sisters, we were discussing this excerpt of the Divine Kumail supplication. حتى أسرح إليك في ميادين السابقين وأسرع إليك في البارزين. So that I move easily towards you in the battlefields of the foremost. So that I hurry to you among the prominent. وأشتاق إلى قربك في المشتاقين. So that I desire fervently your proximity among the fervently desirous. وأدنو منك دنو المخلصين. So that I move near to you with the nearness of the sincere. وأخافك مخافة الموقنين. So that I fear you with the fear of those who have conviction. وأجتمع في جوارك مع المؤمنين. And gather with the believers in your nearness. We said that the exemplar of mu'min, the true meaning of mu'min is the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam. And Imam Ali alayhi as-salam is teaching us to ask from the Almighty Allah to be with true mu'min in the hereafter. Now, what is the meaning of Ahlul Bayt that we say they are the exemplar of true mu'min, the meaning of mu'min? Let's refer to the Holy Quran to see what the meaning of Ahlul Bayt is. In the 33rd verse of this Quranic chapter, Ahzab, we read, إِنَّمَا يُرِيدُ اللَّهُ لِيُذْهِبَ عَنْكُمُ الرِّجْسَ أَهْلَ الْبَيْتِ وَيُطَهِّرَكُمْ تَتْهِيرًا. Allah only desires to keep away the uncleanness from you, O people of household, O Ahlul Bayt, and to purify you with a thorough purifying. Now, the pronoun kum, meaning you in Arabic, does not obviously refer to the wives of the Holy Prophet, and this is what we know for sure. Although they knew that the Holy Prophet's wives, including Aisha and a group of their own scholars, considered Imam Ali alayhi salam, Lady Fatima, and Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein and the infallible Imams from the offspring of Imam Hussein as the members of the Ahlul Bayt, their enmity with the Shi'is motivated them to distort the truth to please the Abbasi and Bani Umayyah rulers. These people are the ones who intended to create a deviation in the Muslims' opinion.
Strengthen my limbs for your service and sustain the strength of my hands to preserve in your service and bestow upon me the eagerness to fear you and constantly serve you so that I may lead myself towards you in the field with the vanguards who are in the fore rank and be swift towards you amongst those who hasten towards you and urge eagerly to be near you and draw myself towards you like those who sincerely draw themselves towards you and to fear you like the fear of those who believe firmly in you and that I may join the congregation of the faithful congregated near you.
Thank you, Allah, now that we're here feeling so good about all the things that we went through knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true. Feeling the peace all around, seeing things we could never imagine, hearing the sound of rivers flow, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is in. indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
Numerous narrators have reported that the Holy Prophet ﷺ has mentioned Imam Ali alayhi salam, Lady Fatima, Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein, and the infallible Imams from Imam Hussein's issue as the Ahlul Bayt. Those narrators are different, but the most reliable books of Sunni scholars have also recorded the true meaning of Ahlul Bayt as reported by those narrators. Shi'i scholars too, by relying on the Holy Quran and the previous narrations, as well as their own authentic books, attach their hearts to the Ahlul Bayt. They consider them as the true leaders and successors of the Holy Prophet. That is because they have understood the true meaning of Ahlul Bayt. That is why obeying the Ahlul Bayt is deemed obligatory and a means for salvation in this world and hereafter. So, we will only mention one narration because we assume that would be appropriate and that would suffice for our discussion in this episode for the true meaning of believers and the Ahlul Bayt. One of the companions of Imam Hussein alayhi salam says, I heard from Hussein ibn Ali and prophets in the Prophet's mosque that at the time of his father Ali, he was saying, I have heard the saying of Allah's Messenger, Ala inna ahla bayti amanun lakum. Behold, my Ahlul Bayt are security and mercy for you. فَأَحِبُّهُمْ لِحُبِّي. Therefore, love them for my sake. وَتَمَسَّكُوا بِهِمْ لَن تَضِلُّوا. And resort to them so that you will never go astray. عَلِيٌّ وَسِبْطَاي وَتِسْعَةٌ مِنْ وُلْدِ الْحُسَيْنِ. These are Ali, my two grandsons, and the nine born of Hussein, who are trustworthy and infallible imams. أَئِمَّةٌ أُمَنَاء مَعْصُومُونَ. They are infallibles. أَلَا إِنَّهُمْ أَهْلُ بَيْتِي وَعِتْرَتِي. Be aware, behold, that they are my Ahlul Bayt and my honor, min lahmi wa dami. They are from my flesh and my blood. Now, it is clear that the Shi'is, by relying on the Holy Quran and traditions, resort to the Ahlul Bayt and accept their imamah. That is why they are following these Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam. And they have evident proof based on the books written by both Shi'i and Sunni scholars. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.